This is a Discovery Channel podcast. Check out Discovery Network's complete podcast lineup at discoverychannelradio.com.
Many of the glories of ancient Rome still exert their magic on this modern city. But few would guess that underneath their feet lies one of Imperial Rome's most remarkable achievements, a key to understanding what made this civilization prosper. A hidden Rome, invisible to most, coursing under the ancient stones, 2,000 years old and still functioning, a marvel of engineering skill, the Virgin Aqueduct.
L'acquedotto Vergine fu costruito verso il 10.
The Virgin Aqueduct was built around 10 or 12 BC by Agrippa, the husband of Julia, the daughter of the Emperor Augustus. And Agrippa was a great general and a marvelous builder. And he built the aqueduct very rapidly and with great stability.
As Rome's first water commissioner, Agrippa brought honor to the position, doubling the city's water supplies. Following in his footsteps, chief engineer Gerolimo Bardi has spent more than 40 years with the water department. Catherine Rennie, a senior Fulbright fellow, is writing a history of the role of water in the urban development of Rome. She's mapping the hidden network of water under the streets, relating it to the fountains above.
As a total system, it's rather extraordinary. There are wonderful descriptions from Frontinus, who was the curator of the water system in 97 AD. And he asked us, how dare we consider those idle pyramids or those useless monuments of the Greeks when there was this phenomenal Roman system of water?
From the source of the water in the hills surrounding the city, the Romans built channels of brick, stone, and concrete. With nothing more than the principle of gravitas, or gravity, to guide them, they carried the water in a vast network throughout the city, supplying the baths, the homes of wealthy citizens, and the public fountains. Three of the 11 aqueducts still function today. The Virgin Aqueduct culminates in Trevi Fountain, one of the city's most famous sites. Gerolimo Bardi points out that part of the sculpture tells the story of the aqueduct.
The origin of the Aqua Virginae, the name Virgin, comes from this pure young girl who showed the soldiers of Agrippa where the source of the water was located. And now we find ourselves here in the zone of the Calatino, around 20 kilometers from Rome, where in these peaceful flowered fields the girl showed Agrippa's soldiers where to find the source of the virgin water.
With a constantly renewing source from the mountains, the reservoir under these fields has supplied water to Rome since its earliest days. As in ancient times, small pyramids marked the precious route of the aqueduct underground. But now they're made of concrete instead of marble. The Virgin Aqueduct is unique in that almost all of it was built underground, even in this city. This subterranean route ensured its survival.
It was the aqueduct's good fortune because when the barbarians arrived, they couldn't damage it, which is what happened to the other aqueducts that were out of the ground and sustained by arches.
Most of the city's above-ground aqueducts were vulnerable to attack and were destroyed when the Goths conquered Rome in 537 AD, cutting off the city's water. During the Renaissance, the popes restored the emperor's practice of building fountains and public drinking spots at points along the aqueducts. Though times have changed, Catherine Rennie still calls these fountains the essence of life in Rome.
They're like punctuation marks in the landscape, and it's the point at which the aqueduct demonstrates itself, and I began to see them, especially when I began to understand how they're connected underground, as almost like beads on a rosary, in that they operate as moments of pause. You stop and it's a moment of contemplation. They almost grab you by the neck and force you to stand and pay attention to them.
Beyond the walls of ancient Rome, then straight down, a city below the city is home to almost a million dead. Deep in the catacombs, crypts and bones have tales to tell. Father Joost Janssens is a Jesuit from Belgium. He came to Rome in 1970 to study theology and Christian archaeology. like the structural details in the catacomb Priscilla.
It's a question of money. Some people, they had a little bit money, and they could afford to buy more space in the cemetery. It's like in our days here, you see a small space, I think, for a little baby.
In the 4th century BC, Roman law made it illegal to burn or bury dead bodies inside the city. In the first few centuries after Christ, booming populations on both sides of the grave made Romans desperate for space. When abandoned stone quarries outside the city started looking like perfect repositories for dead bodies, the catacombs were born. 100 miles of underground paths snake through Rome's 100 separate catacombs.
The catacombs are important to Christianity because they give us a good idea about their respect for their dead.
Along the underground paths, grave diggers carved spaces to hold the dead. Relatives wrapped corpses in linen and put them in tombs that often already held family members.
We have here in the catacombs about 750,000 tombs. So if you like to know something about real people, Christian people of Rome, go to see the catacombs, real people. If you're interested to know something about bishops and popes, you can come too. And that's a good thing too. I like that to say that. But if you like to stay with normal, real people of every day, go and look at their tombs and at their inscriptions.
The catacombs of St. Domitilla, several miles south of the ancient city, form one of Rome's biggest underground cemeteries. Only experts know it well enough to negotiate its mazes.
Here's one of the more interesting places in ancient Rome. These are pieces of the old Rome underworld. It's more than 7 meters deep and lined with sidewalks.
Independent archaeologist Carlo Pavia knows St. Domitilla better than almost anyone. His wife Anna has gotten to know it too.
I'm lucky to have a wife who goes with me into these underworld places. From the moment we met, when we still studied at the university, she's accompanied me into several underworld places. And naturally, I hope she would follow me for a long time.
Anna still joins Carlo on some of his working trips, including one that could have been their last.
We came to this splendid place full of pictures and painted walls, beautiful things to see. Then we started back the way we came. Suddenly, I stopped. Something was wrong. I looked around and everything looked the same. Confusion hit me. My wife asked, "What's the matter, Carlo? We're lost, but let's stay calm, or things will be even more dangerous." We remembered a group of 40 school children who years ago got lost here. Only one escaped, coming out 35 kilometers from the room we're standing in. We went ahead and tried to recall the most important points we saw on the way in. She started to cry, but didn't panic. We could spend all this time looking, and fear will get stronger and would debilitate you into a terrifying state of mind, absolute madness. After a few seconds, with a bit of mental visualization, with a bit of self-control, we realized we'd only find our way out with our senses. We turned our faces to feel the temperature, and little by little, I felt the cooler air. We took the path, and suddenly we found the light. It was a horrifying experience. If we'd stayed completely panic-stricken, we'd still be here today looking for a path.